Welcome to Police Stories Podcast. This is episode 74, and this is a series of short stories about my 28-year career in the UK Police Force. Hope you've been enjoying it. If this is your first time, welcome. But if not, welcome back. You might want to start from the beginning, I regularly say. Quite a few episodes in. Thanks very much for the downloads this week. As you know, we hit the 20,000 downloads last week. That's great. I think we've had another 1,000 already, so it's really increasing and going very well. So thank you. Some other comments on YouTube, which is good. And also, you've got the option of buying me a coffee. If you go onto that site, you can let me wet my whistle if you appreciate what I'm doing. Hope you're all well. Absolutely freezing here today. Got about -2 and lots of ice about with snow forecast. I've got a hot drink on the go with me today, so there might be the odd gulping noise. I apologise, but it's either that or a freeze. So let's get on with today then. So haven't been in Police Scotland long at this point in my career, as you know, transferred up from the Met. And you heard about the roll around, as I'd call it, last week, which was pretty much my opening shift. And as time went on, I continued on. I was back on response in uniform. So I was doing, you know, everything and anything, answering the calls, you know, and all sorts of weird and wonderful things come in. Doesn't matter where you work, you know, but there was an awful lot of variety for me, some of which you'll hear for sure. On this particular occasion, on the incident we're going to talk about today, again, quite an unusual one for sure. And what happened was I came on a night shift, so started at, I think it was 10 p.m. And at that point, there would have been a second shift on as well. So if you remember, I said there was a crossover, so you had the back shift or the late turn on and us coming on as well. So there was about a two-hour sort of handover period where you had two teams on, which, or two groups, which certainly made life a lot easier in terms of resources. Although the reality is when you came on duty, you find that the back shift were already committed, you know, so there'd probably be jobs outstanding, calls to be attended, but no one to go until we came on duty. And that was quite frustrating many of the time when I was on back shift, when I knew that we had things that we needed to do, but we just didn't have the people. The thing that springs to mind is the arrest of perhaps a particularly violent individual, and you didn't really want to go just with two cops. You know, you wanted to take four or six even maybe by the time you start covering rear exits and things. You know, you need a few people, and if someone's really going to kick off, you know, that's probably going to need six of you to safely restrain them, which again we covered last week. Anyway, off on my first tangent already, I apologize. And so the first call we had that night, it was quite a busy night. We got called into town centre to reports of a serious assault. Now, in Scotland, we talked about the differences in law. Down in England and Wales, you have offences like ABH, actual bodily harm and assault, and the more serious GBH, grievous bodily harm. You don't have those in Scotland. Of course, you have assault, and it's the same meaning pretty much, but you basically have assault and serious assault. That's kind of it, you know. And the lines are a little bit blurry as to when one kicks in. It used to be certainly down south, kind of if you had a broken skin or a broken bone, that tipped it into the sort of more serious level. So that's probably a reasonable guide for what you'd expect up here in Scotland as well. So this serious assault had happened in a block of flats, and we'd attended, and one person was outside when the first unit got there, and he had quite a serious eye injury and facial injuries, some sort of a fight. I think a bottle had been involved as well, a broken bottle, and he was taken off to hospital. We went to look at the location where it actually happened. Now, that was a flat, but it was secure. We couldn't actually sort of gain entry, or not initially. The first guy was taken off to the hospital, and he'd been there for a little while before he let slip that somebody else had been seriously injured in the course of the assault, and that he believed they were still in that address. Now, up until that point, we maybe didn't have a power to enter until we had that extra bit of information. But as soon as we heard that, you know, potentially there was somebody seriously injured within that property, that gives us power entry without a warrant. So we forced the door, and I didn't have a, you know, a big red key or an actual metal enforcer available. So did it old school with my foot, which always seems very impressive, but there's a very high chance of putting your back out or hurting yourself in the process. And I do remember that the door went in on about the second kick, and I was all proud of myself. And the young cop I was with, you know, thought he was great. What he didn't see was me turn away and wince and kind of hobble off, you know. So you think you're being clever. And that, of course, is why, you know, proper training and also, you know, proper equipment came in that made life a lot easier and you're less likely to injure yourself. Perhaps I'm just a wimp, I don't know. Anyway, we got the door open, we went into the address, and there'd clearly been, you know, a big fight in there. You know, there was stuff everywhere and tables overturned and smashed TV and things like that. And it's interesting, you shouldn't assume too much, because I've been to addresses like that and said to them, you know, wow, you know, there's been a massive fight in here. Have you been burgled or something? You know, the place is turned upside down, and they kind of look at you quizzically and sort of go, no, it's always like this. Nothing's happened. And you're like, oh, okay. You know, it's just different people live in different ways. So, yes, we basically confirmed that nobody was in the address. There was no injured party in there. And then we re-secured the door. And we came away from that address, the two of us. And time had gone on now. You know, I've talked about this in 2 or 3 minutes. But actually, in this process, sort of at least 2 hours had passed now. So it was kind of maybe 1 o'clock in the morning now, something like that. And we had another call now. And this is the actual incident we're going to talk about. Very strange call came initially. It was a yacht had run aground on the shore in quite a remote part of our ground. Now, the whole ground was remote, but this part, particularly this beach they were talking about, was particularly remote. And they were saying a yacht had run aground. So straight away, you're thinking, okay, that's, you know, the lifeboat. That's nothing to do with the police. But the call had come from the skipper of the vessel, who said that prior to running the vessel aground, he said that his crew had run the vessel aground, and that prior to calling us, he'd slit the crew's throat and thrown them overboard. So obviously you can imagine that took on a little bit of a different tilt for us. Sorry, just having to have a drink there. So we made off our way to this job. Now, this job was a good 45-minute blue light run from us, and there was no other units available. That was the important point. So we blue lighted off to it. I was driving. I was with my colleague or my neighbour, and we went flying off this job. Very, very rural location. Obviously, you know, completely dark, bearing in mind the time of day. And we had a chat on the way over the sound of the sort of sirens, because certainly my colleague had never attended anything like this. I think he had at the time maybe a year in the job, something like that. And bearing in mind, I'd just come from the Marine unit, you know, and at this point had over 20 years in. I don't think I'd ever dealt with anything quite like this. So we had a chat about possible scenarios and what we may or may not do. But you can only sort of pre-plan so much, because we just didn't know what we were going to find. So we did this blue light run, and we turned up. We knew Coast Guard had been called as well. Now, the Coast Guard in Scotland are particularly good. I'm sure they're good everywhere. I've only ever dealt with them in Scotland, and they're absolutely fantastic. Because of the lack of resources that the police have, they help out on all sorts. Many's the time we've called them out, and they'd come out and help on things like road closures or accidents. You know, they've sort of brought their pickup out and stuck their blue lights on and helped close a road off and things. Because if there's two of you and you've got, you know, a sort of remote country road to close off because there's been a serious accident, you're trying to put a cop either end. Well, how do you achieve that with two cops? If one's got to be at the scene of the accident and you need both ends of the road closed off as well, you can't do that. So several times I've called the Coast Guard for that, and they've actually come out, not in their remit at all, but, you know, they'll bend over backwards to help us, and it was really appreciated. But of course, this was very much a Coast Guard call as well. The lifeboat was called too, but clearly they weren't going to go and get involved, because there was talk of, you know, serious assaults and knives and what have you. The skipper on the phone call said that, you know, him and his crew had been heavily drinking as well, and that probably played a part in the yacht actually running aground. So we got out to this location, and the only way into it was a farm entrance. Now, you know, these things are very difficult to find. You know, phones and things quite often don't help, because you don't have a signal, so you can't sort of look at any sort of mapping system. Nowadays, they use the Find My Location, which is absolutely fantastic app, really, really good. And we'll talk about that more, and perhaps in another one, because it comes in on another incident that we'll talk about. So I'll tell you the details of the app, which is a fantastic resource that anyone can download. So we arrive at this location. Thankfully, the Coast Guard, who knew the area quite well because they came from that area, met us at the farm gate, because I'm pretty confident we'd have missed it. And we had a fairly normal car. It was a sort of SUV, but I don't think it was 4x4. If it was, it was like what I'd call a pretend 4x4. So you had a push button, you know, and you didn't sort of have any diff lock or anything like that, you know, so it wasn't a serious 4x4. And this farm track led through a field down to the beach where this yacht was meant to be. And the Coast Guard knew it, and they said, guys, you know, your car's not going to get across there. You know, do you want to jump in with us? We've got a pickup with proper 4x4. Yeah, sure, that was a great idea. Thanks very much. So me and my two colleagues piled in this thing. Now, there was already three Coast Guards there. So, and me and my colleague were quite big as well, as was most of the Coast Guards from memory. So they had these five kind of burly blokes squeezed into a pickup. It was a fairly uncomfortable ride because it was very, very, you know, rutted and pitted on the way down a you know, real sort of farm track that was going through a field. So it was up and down and bumping and crashing about. And by now it's kind of 2 o'clock in the morning, something like that. We knew that the lifeboat had arrived, and they confirmed that the yacht was on the rocks on its side, but they couldn't see any sign of life other than that, and they weren't going to approach given the scenario. So we got as far as we could, and then we hit the beach, but the tide was out quite a long way. So unfortunately, there was a good kind of, I don't know, like quarter of a mile or something of sand that we had to walk across. So and the Coast Guards rightly said, look, you need to get out here. We're not going to trust our pickup to that sand. I have no idea sort of how squidgy it is. We don't want to sink in the sand, so we'll walk the rest of the way. So we got out and walked, and about halfway there, we found a very dazed, drunk guy kind of wandering around the beach. Now, this is the middle of nowhere. You know, there's not a sort of a residence, a house within, you know, several miles of where we were. And we were probably 5 or 10 miles from the nearest even small village, you know. So it's not a sort of place you expect to see someone. So obviously we went and spoke to him, and it turned out this was the crew. Yeah, this was the crew that the skipper had told us that he'd slashed the throat of. Thankfully, he hadn't. The guy did have injuries. He had thrown him overboard, but they were already aground at that point. So he kind of threw him onto the rocks below the yacht. And because of that, he still had some injuries, I think, to his face, fairly minor sort of, you know, abrasions, grazes and things. The skipper, he told us the skipper had threatened him with a knife and told him, you know, if you don't get off, I'm going to slit your throat. And he said basically that they'd been travelling, you know, they'd left a nearby marina, been travelling overnight or intended to. They'd both been drinking quite a lot, and the skipper had gone down below and gone to sleep and left this guy in charge. Now, I don't know what he was like when he was sober, but he wasn't the most switched on guy when I spoke to him, certainly. And of course, he'd been heavily drinking as well. So little tip from the top there, never leave, you know, a drunk, incompetent person steering your yacht at night, you know, in unfamiliar waters. It's just, you know, something you might want to not do. Because sure enough, he basically got completely confused, couldn't read the chart, and ran this yacht aground on the rocks. Now, most yachts, there is the odd exception, but most yachts have a keel, a great big sticky out bit underneath the actual hull, which keeps it upright, acts as a counterbalance when you're heeled over and you're sailing. And what that means is that when you run aground, if you're on a beach, the boat doesn't rest, you know, bolt upright. It lays over at an angle, probably 45 degrees, because obviously it's the keel won't let it come upright. If it's got no water beneath it, it lays on its side. So it looks all the more dramatic. So we made our way down onto the beach, and by now we could see the yacht in the distance. We could see it had some internal lights on, but it was just sat there. Thankfully, it wasn't a particularly rough night. Sorry, I forgot to say that we sent the guy back to the car with one of the Coast Guards, who gave him some basic first aid, but it was more warming him up and, you know, some sort of, you know, plasters and things. It was fairly minor. So he went back to the car, but there was certainly an assault involved in terms of arresting this guy. So there was no problems with a power of arrest. And we could see the yacht on its side as we approached. And we had a quick chat with my colleague. And I said, one thing we need to bear in mind is, because that was the other thing, they'd done some checks on this guy. And not only was he found to be, this is the skipper of the yacht, not only had they found him to be very violent, he had previous for a serious assault where, bizarrely, he'd set fire to a boat with people in it. And he'd been arrested. And I think he'd served prison time for that. He hadn't long come back from America, and he'd been sailing this particular yacht there. And then he led us to believe later that he'd sailed it across to the UK, which is possible. You know, when it was upright and not laying on the rocks, it was quite a capable boat, I think. And maybe he was too, I don't know. So, yeah, we had a chat between me and my colleague that this is a very violent individual. This is what we call impact factors when it comes to figuring out what level of force you can use, and also subsequently writing any statement in terms of evidence that you're going to give to a court. The impact factors are really important because, you know, if I attend a scene and there's a 13-year-old girl who's sort of 4 foot tall who calls me a nasty name, that doesn't give me, you know, the justification to put her in some sort of, you know, throat lock, strangle her, throw her to the floor, stamp on her and handcuff her. You know, that clearly that's very over the top, even for the Met, you might think. But so I'm joking. But on the other hand, if I turn up to the scene of a fight in a pub and there's a very large muscular male in front of me who, you know, clearly knows what he's doing, is showing some signs of specialist training, i.e. some martial arts or some boxing or something like that by the stance he's taken up and the position of his hands. And let's say I've also got a back injury, which I seem to have fairly regularly. And again, we'll talk about that at some point because some of those injuries came through the job. You know, that changes things altogether. Now, I might be able to justify, because of this large male with specialist knowledge and my, you know, injury already, you know, let's say he's got a broken bottle in his hand or something, you know, that the impact factors go through the roof, and the level of force that I could justify using against that male become huge. You know, I could straight away draw my baton and maybe, you know, hit him in the head with a steel baton. You know, you could justify that sort of level, which potentially is fatal, but, you know, you can see the difference between the impact factors. So coming back to the yacht scenario, we had a discussion between us. And I said, look, we're by ourselves. This is a very violent male. There is no backup, full stop. It's not like it's half an hour away, it's 10 minutes away. There's no one available at all. Even if they were, they're going to have, you know, at least an hour by the time they're blue lighted to us, got in the pickup, been driven down to the beach. So we're on our own, effectively. You know, so you add in the remoteness, the violence, you know, and the fact that we're by ourselves, that puts the impact factors very high. So I was saying to my colleague, you know, this is really up the ante. If this guy kicks off, we need to do pretty much anything that it takes to restrain him and get him secured and handcuffed if it takes. And I said to him, to give you an example, if that involves picking up a rock off the beach and hitting him on the head, if he's attacking me, let's say, you know, that's justifiable. These are the sorts of quick discussions we had. And I wanted to make sure that he was clear on that because of his level of service. And I think it only made him more nervous, quite frankly. And I said, look, I'll take the lead. So we walk up to the yacht. The yacht's on its side. And it wasn't rough, but there was waves hitting it. So the yacht was moving about. There was waves sort of crashing. It's perhaps a bit dramatic, but certainly breaking onto the keel. So every time that happened, the yacht would move. We didn't know if, you know, the yacht was likely to get dragged back into the sea, or if the tide was coming in, whether it was going to sort of try and refloat itself or what was happening. So it was certainly something to bear in mind. I looked through the windows, or tried to look through the windows of the yacht, but I couldn't see because it was much higher than me and I couldn't see. So we shouted out initially, hi, anybody in there? I was like knocking on the hull because you can hear that very clearly inside. There was no movement inside. There was nothing at all. So we thought, well, that's a bit strange. Maybe he's, you know, maybe he's already gone and he's wandering around the beach here somewhere, the skipper. We're not sure. Anyway, I carried on shouting a bit and knocking on the hull, and eventually there was a voice inside. So I said to him, you know, come out and speak to me. He refused. He wouldn't do that. He said, I'm staying on my boat. I've had enough. You know, and then he started raving and raging about, you know, the fact that this idiot had run his pride of, you know, his pride of joy up on the beach, you know, and that he was going to kill him. He was still telling us he was going to kill his crew because he'd done that, you know. And he was basically winding himself up and was clearly pretty angry. So it wasn't a perfect scenario. So, We had a little think. Now, I could climb in the cockpit where you sit on the yacht, but it was going to be quite difficult because of the angle and the height it was above me and the fact that the yacht was continually moving with the waves. We told the lifeboat to stand off, you know, be close, but not too close, sort of stay in the boat and nearby should the boat move. And so they were doing that. The Coast Guards were with us, but we told them to keep right back. So they were a good kind of 50 yards away. And we said, look, just don't get involved. We'll deal with this. Although I did point out that, you know, should this guy get out and he's some sort of, you know, Bruce Lee ninja and he's basically killing me, maybe you'd come over and help, jokingly, you know. So eventually it was decided the only way that I could speak to this guy was to get up into the cockpit. And in the meantime, the control room had dispatched some STOs, which are basically taser-trained officers, specially trained officers, STOs, and they are trained in the use of taser, and they will come and assist us. But they were coming from like Glasgow or somewhere. I think their ETA was about 2 hours, so it was virtually pointless. Anyway, I managed to climb up the side of the keel and sort of scrabble my way and eventually get into the cockpit and try and speak to this guy. And he actually wasn't sort of doing anything particularly bad at that point. The yacht was heeled right over at sort of 45 degrees. He was sat in his bunk and he was telling me, I just want to go to sleep, basically. Just leave me alone. I'm not coming out. Equally, you're not coming in. He was very clear on that. And he said something like, you know, don't come in or see what happens, you know. So it's pretty clear he didn't want us in there. And I said, look, you can't stay here. You know, we had a chat. I think the tide was coming in. The lifeboat's concerned. You know, I've been at sea for years. I know what I'm doing. Don't tell me what to do on my own boat. You know, this is the sort of stuff I was getting back with a good smattering of, you know, swear words and threats towards me as well. So he was pretty angry. But I said, look, this is going to have to be resolved one way or another. You need to come off. But he basically said, I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying here and you're not coming in. So that's kind of, I've condensed, you know, like a half an hour, 45 minute talk. And we got nowhere with it, really. So eventually I climbed off. And all the time, obviously, I'm updating the control room. I've probably got my timings a little bit wrong there because it was probably only another half an hour or so now before the STOs turned up, amazingly, and we sent the Coast Guard, or we asked the Coast Guard to go back up to the farm track and collect the two guys, the cops with tasers. They came down, nice couple of guys, very young in service, very inexperienced, had never done anything like this before, and you wouldn't expect it because who had, do you know what I mean? I'd been in a long time and hadn't either. It was pretty unique, even for this area. So we had a quick chat and we basically you know, sort of talk through the various options. One thing we were slightly concerned was that he probably had access, certainly to pyrotechnics on board. There would have been emergency flares. Now, if one of those was fired at you close range, you know, they're like a firework on steroids. So that would, you know, do you some serious injury, if not kill you, if he fired, you know, a parachute flare straight at you sort of thing. And he may have had, because we'd also talked with the crew that had come off about what he had on board. And he said he thought he had a flare gun on board as well, which is a similar thing, but obviously in a sort of pistol type form with a huge cartridge that gets loaded into it. So these are all things we had in our mind. And basically, I said to the guys, you know, I'll take the lead if you want, because I've already got the rapport with stretching it, because, you know, we were by no means friends. But I said, we'll get on as well. There's only space for two of us. So one of you come on with the taser and as a backup, and we'll just really keep an eye on his hands and we'll try and convince him to come off. In the meantime, my colleague, who was down on the sort of rock still, was just having a little search around the edge of the boat, because there was a few bits and pieces that come off the boat. And one of the things he found was a very large carving knife, probably like a 12-inch blade. And He picked that up, unfortunately, and bearing in mind our remoteness, we didn't have any weapons tubes. Normally, you'd have like a long plastic tube that you'd put potential evidence in and seal it up, but we just didn't have that luxury. So he basically, you know, put a pair of gloves on and secured it, because from the description that the guy who'd been thrown off the boat gave us, you know, this was the knife that had threatened him. He described it on the way down when we spoke to him as a very large carving knife. So that was secured, albeit not perfectly, because it ended up just sort of sitting, I think, on top of a jacket on some rocks until we could figure out what to do with it. So I climbed back on with the STO, with the taser officer, and I re-engaged with this guy and we had a chat. And it took some time. Luckily, I had, a reasonable amount of boating knowledge. I'm sort of fairly into my sailing. Obviously, I had all the marine unit sort of background. I knew a bit about boats and yachts, so I used that as a way into this guy to talk to him, and it worked reasonably well. You know, eventually we got a little bit of a rapport going and a bit of banter, quite frankly. Sometimes, you know, even though you don't want to and you might not like the person, you have to be able to have a little sort of laugh and a joke with them. It's the only way you can get them on side, you know, or on board. See what I did there? Eventually I said, look, you cannot stay here all night. You know, you're going to have to come off. Let's make this, you know, as easy as we can. And eventually he agreed to come off. But before he got off, I made sure that before he climbed into the cockpit, that he just sort of turned out his pockets and he'd put everything to one side. You know, I didn't want him bringing loads of stuff. And I said, look, it's going to be okay here in the boat. And he took out various things. And obviously we were concerned. As he came up through the hatch, we got hold of a wrist each and we helped him into the cockpit. Now, we didn't handcuff him because he wasn't violent with us and we could have easily justified it, and normally I would have. But realistically, how was he going to climb off this yacht at a 45 degree angle when you've handcuffed him? Chances are he's just going to fall off and brain himself on the rocks. So we couldn't really justify that. So in the end, we basically had to, you know, I think the STO climbed off first, then, you know, our suspect did, and then I climbed down behind him, and then we sort of got hold of him. And I think then we handcuffed him to the front, which again, I wouldn't normally do in that scenario, but we wanted him secure, but equally he was going to need his hands. He was properly searched then. There was nothing else on him in terms of weapons and things. He did have a few things in his jacket pocket, but nothing that was going to sort of cause any harm. So they were just put back into his jacket pockets. Now remember that, because that will come in later. So he had a jacket on. Now, the tide had come in. It hadn't cut us off, but it had made life a lot more difficult to get back to where the Coast Guard's pickup was. And because the lifeboat was there, it was decided that now he was secure and there was no risk from him, we could bring the lifeboat right in and pretty much nudge up to the rocks. We would jump on the lifeboat and there was a marina nearby. They would take us to there, and we would get another police vehicle to meet us there, and we could put him into the prison van from there. It'd be a lot easier than trudging back across this muddy, sandy, slippery rock beach, you know, for however long. So that's what we did. The only slight issue was my colleague, they insisted on everyone putting life jackets on, of course, which was not a problem, but it was difficult to get it on our guy with handcuffs on. We didn't really want to release them. We also needed to bring with us the large carving knife. So you had this bit of a strange scenario where you had the three cops getting on with their suspect, handcuffed to the front, clambering on this inflatable lifeboat. It was a rib, you know, quite a large sort of, I don't know, 8 meter Atlantic lifeboat. We climbed onto the rib, and my colleague, who kept well away from this guy, brought the large carving knife with him as evidence. So luckily it was calm enough that we were able to do that. And then we only had about a 10 minute journey in the lifeboat before we got round to the nearby marina. And sure enough, the police van was there. At this point, we got him up to the van, and then finally I arrested him for assault. Now, you might think that's a bit late, but the reality is you can only do it when it's realistic and safe to do so. So, you know, I just wanted to clarify, which he probably guessed on the count he was with handcuffs with two cops holding him. But, you know, I made the formal arrest and cautioned him, and he got put in the van. And then it's quite a long journey back. It was about an hour or so down the very twisty roads. Now, a lot of people get sick in the back of police vans on these local roads because they're so twisty, you know, particularly if the driver is going a bit quick. But eventually we got him back, and he didn't kick off anymore. Now, he was wet and he sobered up quite a bit by this point. He still had a drink in him, but he wasn't drunk. So as is normal in custody, and again, we'll speak about this in more detail another time, his sort of outer jacket was taken off and he had a more detailed search. Obviously the handcuffs were released, and eventually he was put in a cell, and his jacket was taken off him, and because it was wet, I think it was hung over a radiator in the custody area. And then he was processed in the normal way, and eventually, you know, he got charged with assault. There was no sort of maritime type offences. They just stuck with the assault on the guy. I think there was several counts of assault, and there might have been a couple of other things in there as well. And he eventually, it took about 2 or 3 years because I think COVID came fairly soon after. But, you know, he got a very minor sentence, as is generally the case. You know, he didn't get any prison time or anything. I think he got a fine, you know, and a conviction. That was about it. But the follow-up is that he made a formal complaint afterwards and said that not only had I stolen his Rolex, and of course it would be a Rolex, wouldn't it? It wouldn't be, you know, like a Casio, you know, digital watch that's worth about tenner. This was a 2 grand, you know, Rolex that, you know, his great auntie Ethel had left him. And I'd also stolen his gold bullion. Now, he said that he had gold bullion on the yacht and that he'd specifically brought it off and he didn't want to leave it on the boat, so he'd put it in his coat pockets, which he brought with him. And then when I took his coat off him, I must have stolen the gold bullion at that point because he never got it back. So he put in this great big complaint and about the fact that, you know, we'd stolen his watch and we'd stolen his, you know, his gold bullion and what have you. But it was obviously spurious. It clearly wasn't the case. But this is what I was saying again about the body-worn cameras, you see, because had we had body-worn on, you probably could have proved that none of that had happened. But as it was, you know, I stayed under investigation for, it was well over a year. I say under investigation, it wasn't like I was held in a cell or anything. You know, they let me know they were investigating. Complaints came down, took a few statements, you know, spoke to the guy again, did what they could, looked at some CCTV from custody and various places. And after, you know, a good time, you know, year or two, told me that, you know, I'd been found kind of not guilty, if you like. It's not a term they use, but that's effectively what it means, you know, that there was no case to answer and I hadn't stolen anything, which was the case. But it just shows how people, you know, will try and muddy the waters if they can. But yeah, a bit of a different one, certainly. And bearing in mind, I've been that long on the Marine unit and never dealt with anything like this. And here I am turning up in remote Scotland and then dealing with a job like that. So it's certainly an unusual one. Could have gone very pear-shaped, you know, could have had all sorts of nightmares, could have had injuries on the boat, you know, a guy could have attacked us. All sorts of scenarios spring to mind. Thankfully, they didn't happen, hopefully because of the way we approached it. But hope you enjoy the story and come back next week. We've got plenty more for you. Take it easy. Have a good week. Cheers. Bye.